Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Right Club. The first rule of Right Club is you don't talk about Right Club, but we'll make an exception in your case. Hello again, I'm Linda. Welcome to Right Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. Today, I'm joined by Pat, Heather, Teresa, Stephanie, and Nicola. We have a full house.
Hello!
Hi.
This week on Right Club, we're going to hear from Steph, who's going to read from a work in progress. And Pat's going to be telling us something about the British Library and their collection of erotic fiction. That's our theme today, erotic fiction. We're going to have a wonderful interview with Bambi Lynn, who writes erotic fiction. And we're going to hear what Heather and Teresa have on their bedside tables. But first, Nicola's going to ask us to
name the novel.
Right, are you ready?
Yep.
This book is regarding a rich English woman in middle age recounting her memoirs.
That's it?
Yeah, at the moment.
A rich English woman.
A rich English woman in middle age recounting her memoirs.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Published
originally in London in 1748 and 1749,
Ooh.
It came
oh,
out in two instalments, and it was written while the author was in debtor's prison.
Uh-huh. Oh. I think I have an inkling.
Oh. But she was rich.
Interesting. Okay, or is it?
The book exemplifies the use of euphemism. No dirty words or explicit scientific terms were used, but there was plenty of use of the word nethermouth.
What?
Is it Fanny Hill?
It's the memoirs of a woman of pleasure, popularly known as Fanny Hill.
Yeah. By John
Cleland.
I didn't know it was called the memoirs of a woman of pleasure. I've just known it as Fanny Hill.
I have to tell you, there were some pretty rude drawings on Wikipedia as well.
And lots of use of the terms
nethermouth.
What's a nethermouth? Sorry, cut that bit out.
It's the nether region.
Nobody can see you blush.
Right.
Oh, God, I'm so stupid.
She is. And now we're going to hear from Steph, who's going to read from her new work in progress.
Well, actually, this is a... I thought I'd share this with you because of the subject matter today. This is probably the closest I'll ever get to erotic fiction. But this is actually, remember I talked about that course that I did with Faber?
Mm-hmm.
This was one of the exercises, and I mentioned it, I think, last week, that, you know, you were told to set a timer for 15 or 20 minutes and write something and then post it straight away. So you didn't get a lot of chance to edit it, which I'm sure will show. But I thought I'd share it with you because it's a bit of fun, I think. It's about a phone call, let me just say. Okay. Perhaps I answered an unknown ID call because the conversation with Sophie had just started to run out of steam. First dates are hard work. You start off comparing favourite bands and then you talk about how much school bores you, or you discuss A-level choices, depending on whether she wants to be a model or a lawyer. When the conversation gets all stilted, that's when I'm in danger of saying something dumb and ruining my chances. Once I was with a girl, I really did fancy her, and there was this long silence, and I just pointed into the air and said, "Oh, look, a dead bird." That isn't as random as it sounds. It's one of my granddad's favourites. He says it all the time and then wheezes with laughter when everyone looks up. So when my phone rang, I just answered it as much for something to do as anything else. I'd give my Holly Pierce calendar not to have done that, but I did, and now I can't not have done it. At first, I was just rolling my eyes at Sophie in apology and shouting, "Hello, it's Tom, who is this, please?" But in a tone that said, "Who are you, idiot, and why are you disturbing me?" And then I heard a muffled voice, which I thought I recognised in that sort of, "I know that voice, even though I don't know who you are" kind of way. Sophie had stood up and was pointing to my cup and opening her eyes all wide, so I gave her a thumbs up and she went to the counter. A thumbs up! Oh, Lord, shoot me now. I strained to make out the voice again, but there were just whooshing noises now. No one was speaking. Once my granddad had just got back from holiday in Cornwall and he showed me a big shell. He said it was magic. "Listen hard and you'll hear the sea," he said. And I heard it. I believed him, and every time I visited, he'd take down the enchanted shell and listen to the sea. Anyway, that was the kind of sound I was hearing on the phone, like the waves lapping on shingle. There was a music to it, a rhythm, like a dog panting or a heart beating. Then there was another voice, not the woman's voice from before. This one was deeper, a man. He wasn't actually saying anything worth saying. It was a sort of groan with words in it, not succinct. And then the woman made a moaning sound, which sounded like she was in pain. And still there was this gentle thud, thud, thud in the background. I went cold. I wanted to throw that phone as far from away from myself as I could, but it was like it was welded to my ear for a few seconds. I was paralysed. I couldn't move. I just had to screw my eyes up really tight and try to pretend it wasn't happening. Sophie came back with my coffee. "Who was that?" she asked. "Only my mum." My lips stuck to my teeth. "Checking up on you, eh?" "No, her new boyfriend works in the Apple store and I think she's got a new phone. It was a pocket dial."
And I was convinced that somebody had been kidnapped.
Oh, the innocence.
I think you really brilliantly established the voice of the teenage boy without being too obvious. I think it was really, really... I had to look up. I didn't know who Holly Pierce was.
No, I didn't.
So I looked that up. Well, she's a lady who needs a bigger size in underwear. But all the pictures of her were in her underwear, two sizes too small. So I can see why a boy might want to calendar off her. Okay. But anyway, but no, I think you did that really well without overplaying it or being a bit being too obvious. I thought that was great, and it's just funny. It's just funny, very very funny. Great description of what's going on the phone with the flashback to the shell and everything, because it, you know, it's that thing like you don't know what you're hearing, and then just brilliantly done. I thought
someone had been kidnapped.
Right to the very end.
I've got very confused. Yeah.
I particularly like Grandad and the dead bird bits. Yes. I love that. And Grandad wheezing with laughter. I just absolutely love that.
That was wonderful. Yeah. I thought it was just brilliant the way you said, "Oh, it's my mum."
Yeah.
Pocket dial.
That
was great.
That was actually the subject of the. That was actually the prompt we were given. Pocket dial.
Oh, really? Brilliant. Yeah. Okay.
And I just said, "What is that?" It's only that somebody said what it was.
One of the things, Stephanie, this is 551 words. So with a little bit of editing, it would make a brilliant piece of flash fiction.
That's right.
Get it down to 500 words, and you could enter that into a flash fiction competition. Because think it is, it works. It's effective. Yeah, it's funny. It's different.
There's a turning point in the middle.
Yeah,
I was thinking that the lady in question is one of the ladies in my house.
Yes,
I was just really.
Yeah, or it could be.
She could be a completely embarrassing mother, couldn't she? Mm.
Aren't we all?
Yeah.
I worked very hard at it.
I liked the way that you established the central character's sort of persona. I like that. Mm-hmm. And I like the way as well, those little asides and the thing about the granddad just helped to create a sympathetic character. So at the end, you do really feel his pain. A couple of things I picked up on. I just wasn't happy with the thud, thud, thud. But I didn't know what to suggest as a better sound. Well,
Heather's just completely lost it. What would you like instead of a thud, thud,
slap,
thud?
Slap, slap,
slap. No.
Well, Steph usually goes to the seashore, waves.
Well, this is why she introduced the shell, because she got that sound of the waves on shingle. And I thought, this is what she really wants.
Right. Well, I thought we were still talking about the heart beating dog panting thing.
We are.
Yeah.
Are we missing a comma? A semicolon?
No. Just you wait till you need advice.
The thing is, if I've got to get it under 500 words, I can only afford two thuds anyway.
No, I think you can keep that. I think a little bit of a word here, a word there.
It was just
for the benefit of our listeners. Pat just showed us a brilliant head tossed in indignation.
No, it was. Well, heart beating, dog panting doesn't sound like thud thud.
Well, the other thing. Things have moved on.
Yeah.
It's from the heavy breathing.
Thank you, Pat. I will take that into account. I haven't really given this a lot of polishing yet.
Okay. Because, so to speak.
Stop it.
Old people.
Succinct. I wasn't sure that succinct was the right word.
Word for a teenage boy. Yeah. I agree with
you. Well, no, not even that. Not succinct means not sharp.
Words, yeah, because it was the man
said to the point.
Yeah, the man's making a sort of groan with words in it.
Yeah. What is he saying?
I don't know. He's probably like, oh, you're wonderful. Or something like that. I don't know. But you're quite right. Not succinct is, I didn't think, when I read it, I thought, that's not a kind of teenage boy kind of expression, is it? Oh, he wasn't succinct. I mean, that's much more of a.
Stephanie, can I just say, don't go in for a career of phone sex. Because that, wonderful. That's going to do it for anything.
It sounded very uncertain, put it that way.
Yeah, I'm going to make a fortune on that. But the story was good.
It was good. And, oh, boy. Well, we're going to have a lot of fun today. Thank you, Stephanie. I hope that feedback was useful. Do any of our listeners have maybe a substitute for the thud-thud-thud?
Yes, competition.
Right. And now it's over to Pat.
Okay. Last month, the British Library's collection of obscene, sexually explicit and erotic novels and writing went online for the first time.
Oh!
You'll all be delighted to know. Called the Private Case Collection, it consists of 2,500 texts, and these include fictional confessions of adventurous ladies, compendiums of London courtesans, and, my favourite, erotic nun novels.
Talk about a subgenre.
Yeah.
The convent education.
Yeah.
So these have now been digitised and made available to registered scholars across the world.
How do you become a registered scholar in the British Library?
You have to join. Before that, there were a series of cupboards in the keeper's room from the 1850s where material that was deemed to be unsuitable was kept locked away, usually because of its obscene nature. And it was added to throughout the 19th century and the 20th century, and this carried on until around 1960, when, of course, as we all know, sex was discovered and everything changed.
Stop locking it away.
Yeah. But the collection dates back to 1658. The earliest piece is the book Rare Verities, The Cabinet of Venus Unlocked and Her Secrets Laid Open.
Ooh.
It also features 40 copies of Fanny Hill that we talked about earlier, which is considered to be the first pornographic novel written in the English language. It contains an account of the sexual exploits of a gentleman named Walter in Victorian England, My Secret Life. And the memoirs
She says like she knows what she's talking
about. Right, right.
And the memoirs of Dolly Morton, an 1899 novel about the erotic adventures of a Quaker woman in the American South. Before the Civil War.
I have to read that.
You haven't encountered that, Linda? No. Okay. There's also a book called Teleny, or The Reverse of the Medal, which tells of the tragic relationship between a young Frenchman and a Hungarian pianist. Authorship of this novel has been attributed to Oscar Wilde and members of his circle in the 19th century. And it's one of the earliest works of male gay erotic fiction in English. and it was particularly shocking at the time.
Wow.
The last item I'm going to mention, I think, apart from the erotic nuns, this is possibly my favourite. Harris's list of Covent Garden ladies, 1757 to 95, is an annual user's guide to the courtesans of London that arranges its entries by name and address.
Excellent.
And also includes information about the women's physical attributes. Oh, so, well. Miss Spencer, number 35, Newman Street. Of course, they leave the vowels out. I don't.
Oh, yes.
Have you encountered yes. that? Yeah. Miss, so it's Miss Sp-NC Sp. So I'm guessing Spencer. Miss Spencer, number 35 Newman Street, is never so good a companion as when a little enlivened with the juice of the grape. Well, aren't we all? Of a Miss Froome from Berwick Street, it advises she's now about 19, of a fair complexion, with blue eyes, tall and elegantly made, with well-formed projecting bubbies that will, without being obliged to stays, keep their original ground. Her parts below, it adds, are very conveniently adapted to any size.
That's quite explicit.
There are enthusiastic reviews for Miss Richardson of Rath...
I think we've lost Stephanie as well.
Stephanie's under the table now.
There are enthusiastic reviews for Miss Richardson of Rathbone Place as creating momentary delirium, and then each part combines to raise up the fallen member. But though Miss Hardy of Newman Street is praised, not knowing how long this train of perfections may last, readers are advised to make hay while the sun shines.
That is brilliant.
Oh, my God, that's so funny.
And that's all in the British Library.
Oh, well, they didn't have the internet, you see, so they had to have, like, a directory.
That's fantastic. I thought about objectifying them. How efficient. If only I'd thought of that. It's a brilliant business idea.
But what amused me was that it's an annual user's
it's like an almanac, isn't it?
It's an almanac. It's a small pocketbook,
apparently. Mm-hmm.
Well, just coming back to Fanny Hill, I mean, it was written in 1748, 1749, but then it was taken down again. In 1821, it was outlawed in the USA, and it didn't make a public appearance again until 1963, when the uncensored version was published by Mayflower Books, upon which they promptly prosecuted the guy who owned Mayflower Books and took all the 45 copies, which probably ended up in the British Library. But it does say that they had sold 10,000 copies before that.
I remember. Remember the Lady Chatterley trial?
And then it was again published in the UK in 1970. So this book's, you know, stood the test of time.
Well, this is all a great surprise to me because I didn't know that British people had sex.
While you were talking, I just remembered something. In pre-revolutionary France, there was obviously, you know, a trade in erotic fiction, under-the-counter stuff. And when you went to the bookseller, if you wanted some under-the-counter stuff, you would say, got any philosophical works?
Oh, that's fantastic.
Well, I looked up some information about erotic fiction, and it sounds to me like we could all kind of support ourselves while we're starving artists by writing erotic fiction. I downloaded this piece by Amy Cooper, who writes erotica, and she's talking about how much money you can make. Since the success of 50 Shades of Grey, many other erotic fiction authors have appeared. And Amy Cooper says now Amazon has allowed any normal person without any publishing background to create their own catalog and publish stories within minutes. And she says it's very easy to do because most of the stories are between 5,000 to 10,000 words. Many of these people find themselves immediately successful, making thousands of dollars within the first month. And I don't know, I don't think everyone does that, but she's giving this example. And she says she's been in this erotica authoring for several years now. And she says, I don't consider myself a great author. I didn't go to school for writing, but I still make over $10,000 monthly writing erotica short stories. Isn't that amazing? Mm. And she said, it does take a lot of time and energy because people, you have to keep feeding it all the time. So she said, you know, you need to keep publishing.
The beast won't be sated.
That's right. Several of these short stories all the time if mm-hmm. you want to keep your readers. So I thought that was just incredibly interesting. But she says, anyone can do it. There's nothing to hold you back, any average person. So there's no reason you can't write a story with sex in it. I think that's, but if you write about rape, mm-hmm. Amazon will block it. Mm-hmm. And so there are some no-nos in mm-hmm. doing this, which there should be, I think. But there are erotica how-to guides on Amazon, and she's created an erotica publishing guide that helps new authors. So I was thinking that kind of money, well, everyone doesn't make that, but we're later going to hear an interview with Bambi Lynn, who is a very successful author, and I can just tell you that she has a huge, beautiful home. And she and her husband have matching Harley Davidson motorcycles. So I think she's doing well. Mm. So are any of you interested in earning big bucks? I don't think Stephanie will make it.
No, I looked into this at some years ago, actually, but it's not for me, I decided. But, you know, some of the websites that take erotic fiction have guidelines, and they're, you know, I don't know if, you know, there are those no-go areas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you have a friend who writes erotic fiction.
Well, we interviewed Sue in one of our podcasts, S.A. Mead, I should mm-hmm. say, yeah. I think her story was she'd written a very good novel, which she couldn't get published. But so she's, as a challenge, I think she wrote about two men, a sex mm-hmm. scene involving two men, and she found she was good at that, and she has a massive following mm-hmm. and a number of mm-hmm. Books behind her. But she is a good writer, uh-huh. and I think one of the things she said was that now her readers are less interested in the kind of visceral writing about sex. They're more interested in the relationships and things, so that right. kind of suits her as well, right. that she's sort of moved right. on from that.
Yeah, Bambi's got quite a lot to say about
that. Yeah, she mm-hmm. has, yeah.
Well, can and we then, hear that then?
Yeah, let's go to Bambi. Hi, Bambi. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Oh, well, we're very happy that you agreed to come on with us. I'm here with Nicola, and I wanted to tell you, Nicola, I met Bambi when I was in the United States this last time. She's a neighbor of my brother, and so he introduced us. We had dinner together, and it was wonderful. I was delighted to talk with you, Bambi.
It was wonderful, and he had been trying to get us together for the last few trips that you had been over.
Right.
So I was glad that we were finally able to make it happen.
Okay, so what's your, tell me your full writing name, Bambi, and give us some of your titles so far.
Okay, so I write under the name Bambi Lynn, and the main reason that I don't use my real name is because I teach eighth graders.
Oh, okay.
Of course, they would be very excited to read some of the things that I write, I try to keep it a secret from them as possible. But so my pen name is Bambi Lynn, and my first books that I had published were published through a traditional publisher, and they include several erotic stories, Viking stories. The Valiant Viking was one, and my very first one, which was set in Pompeii on the day of the eruption, was called Wrath of the Fire God.
Yes,
since then I've Yeah, that was one of my, I just taught ancient Rome, and I kind of showed a video with my class about the events of that day, and it really all brought it back. So I went back and read the book again, and I've forgotten how much I enjoyed writing that book and following the timeline so closely and that kind of thing. It was a lot of fun to do. My most recent book that I have out is called The Vikings, and it's an anthology of short erotic stories about a group of Vikings who invade Normandy.
Wow.
Is that the one with Gunnar, the Norseman?
Yes, yes. Gunnar is the first story in that group of they're erotic shorts, I call them, episodes. And Gunnar is the first story in that.
You call them what?
Erotic stories.
No, she says
erotic shorts.
Okay. I'm very keen on Vikings.
We could call them quickies. We could call them quickies, but you know everybody calls them quickies.
We
have
we are very keen on Vikings myself, having watched the series on television recently. They have a fantastic series on
them. I just love it. And my husband and I have recently started watching The Last Kingdom.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, my goodness. We've just finished season one, and we're kind of halfway through season two of that. And I love seeing the comparison between the Vikings TV show that comes on History Channel and the Last Kingdom, and how that some of the same characters are there, but their personalities are so different and things. So it's very interesting to watch.
Awesome. Well, I wanted to ask, first of all, how you got into this niche. How did you, what interested you, and what brought you here?
Well, I've written for a long time. I wanted to be a writer when I was in high school. You know, it's one of those things you always know you want to do it. And so I'd always wanted to do that. And when I was very early married as a young adult, I went to live in Europe, and I lived in Belgium, and really, really got into the Middle Ages, just the history of it. I'd always been fascinated by that, but so many castles and so many ruins just within, you know, a 5-mile radius of my house was just fascinating to me. So that's when I really started focusing on that kind of time period. And my books had always been very spicy, because I'm just a spicy person and I have a spicy personality. So, you know, that just works into whatever it is that you're writing. So I had always been that way. And I struggled for years to get published. I got numerous rejection letters. Again and again, year after year, it just seemed like my friends were passing me by. I was getting so frustrated. And I went to, we host a reader's luncheon here, my writer's group does. And there was a woman who I was working. And so there was nowhere for me to sit. And she had one seat left at her table. And she was a pretty prolific writer. And she was very successful. She'd been around since the 80s, you know. And she said, and she wrote erotica for an erotic publisher. And she said, well, why don't you send your book to my editor? Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, mm-hmm. Well, my books were spicy, but not what I would call erotica. So with that first book, which was Wrath of the Fire God, I just kind of went through and beefed up the sex a lot more. Yeah. And it did not sell to her publisher, but it sold to another publisher.
Wow.
So then I kind of, so I focused a little bit more on the erotic aspect and realized very quickly, you know, for men, you can just write about sex, you know, and they're happy. But for women readers, there needs to be more a change after the sex. Sex has to have more meaning. It can't just be there to get everybody all excited. It has to change the character. So I started trying to work that in a little bit more. So it was kind of a growth process. And now I kind of try to separate a little bit. I do live in the Bible Belt, which I'm
right.
I moved here. Okay. Right. I moved to the Bible Belt. And so I have to be a little bit more, have the two be a little bit more separate. So I have my historical paranormals that I write that are very spicy, but have a little bit more, a little less crude language, you know, and those kinds of things. And then I have my erotica, which I absolutely market as erotica. They're much shorter stories. And they pretty much focus around either Vikings or gladiators. The one I'm working on right now is a gladiator book. Because, you know, I also feel like I'm more allowed to explore in those time periods,
right?
Because you didn't have to be politically correct back then.
I did want to ask you about the difference between erotica and porn.
That was one of Steph's questions.
Yeah, and how do you keep it from getting into being crude and vulgar? Because what I've read of yours, it really isn't. Can you talk about what you see as the difference there?
Okay.
Yeah.
So really, the whole purpose of porn is the titillation of porn, getting people excited, getting them in the mood, and there's not really a whole lot of depth to it. It's just one sex scene after another. There's not very much internal stuff going on. It's mostly external, physical things. With erotica, there's a lot more internalization going on. Both of the characters, at least one of them, but usually both of them, are internalizing what they're thinking, what they're feeling, how it feels to them physically as well as emotionally. There's the growth aspect of what's going on as far as the porn itself. Now, when I write, the difference between my paranormals and my erotica, you know, in my erotica, I still use pretty crude language. I refer to body parts, even female body parts, in ways that, I don't do in my paranormals. I don't use flowery language in my paranormals, for sure. I'm not really very flowery, but a little bit. Certainly by comparison to what I use in erotica. But I think the emotional aspect and the character growth aspect, that's really the difference between erotica and porn.
It's like sex as a transformation tool, isn't it? It's sort of like,
absolutely.
In the hero's journey terms, it's the powerful object that's given by the mentor kind of thing.
Yes. Oh, yes. And it absolutely is part of the hero's journey. I mean, sex itself, it's not just one sex partner after another. There's definitely a change that takes place because of it.
Right. Wonderful. Beautifully put. Thank you.
Yeah, there's no character development in porn.
No.
Right. We just need well-developed characters in porn.
Yes.
We won't use the podcast, but I have seen the odd bit of porn done by ladies, which is a lot better than...
Oh yeah. It's different. You can absolutely tell the difference in those two things. You know, and it's like I tell my husband about some of the TV series we watch. For example, we love Vikings, we love The Last King, we love Game of Thrones. We started watching Outlander and
there's a lot of sex in Outlander.
Yes, and it's very, very similar, but you can tell the difference. Vikings, The Last Kingdom, those are written by men, primarily for men. Whereas Outlander is written by a woman, primarily for women. So you can totally tell the difference, even though they're similar. The pageantry, the intrigue, it's all very similar. It's definitely a difference.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. You can tell Outlander's going to be good when he comes out of that stream. Is it the first episode? Oh, that bottom.
Oh, beautiful. My goodness. Yes.
Well, I haven't watched it. I guess I'm going to have to.
Yeah, you're doing.
So I tend to kind of focus on women who are not quite so innocent. And so they're perfectly happy to have sex with a man just for the physical part of it. But even if that happens for a reader, somehow, even if the heroine is going into the encounter just for the physical aspect of having sex, one way or another, she wants her to be different afterwards. Either she wants her to have some kind of emotional connection to her partner that she was just with, or her attitude about sex changes, or maybe her attitude about another character. Just the way that we always plan the hero's journey and the character growth from the beginning of the story to the end. And we always want to make sure we have scenes that focus on that character growth. The sex scenes also have to play into that character growth as well.
In each genre, there's specific scenes that you must have. For example, in a police procedural crime novel, you have to have the dead body scene. You have to have the detective at the mercy of the villain scene. Are there certain scenes that have to be included in erotic novels? And it sounds like there might be.
So I have used the hero's journey as a template for years when I'm outlining, and it helps me to not have to edit so much when I go back at the end. And so, yes, you absolutely have to have the introduction scene. And, as I follow the rising action then of the story, you have all the little scenes that put in what the hero or the heroine's fear is, because you need to know what that is right from the get-go. Okay. So you have some kind of scene at the beginning that demonstrates that, you know, not necessarily talking about the time she fell down a well when she was a child, but actually shows her in an environment that makes her recall that. Mm-hmm. So I like to recall that fear. Maybe you don't know why she has that fear. You just know that she has it. So absolutely, there's that. Once the heroine and the hero have sex in the story, then there's that scene afterwards that shows how the sex changed them. Because in the sex scene itself, it's pretty graphic. There's a lot going on. Everybody gets their rocks off. And then there's either cuddling after. It's either cuddling after or not cuddling after, one or the other. But then there's a break, and then there's a scene that follows up, either with both characters or at least the main character, that really demonstrates how that character has changed from the sex that they just had. And then the next sex scene that they have, I usually have in a short erotica of about 100 pages, I usually have at least three big major sex scenes. And each one of those, you've got one that's kind of near the beginning that shows when they first start to trust each other. Because once they have, whether they're having sex, even if it's just for the physical part, there's still a level of trust that has to be there. Even if it's just, you know, milk and cream sex, or if one of them's being tied up one way or the other, there's a level of trust that has to be there. So that's what has to change afterwards. So then you see another sex scene in the middle that kind of builds on that. And then at the end is the one where they decide that they can't live without each other, or they're just going to, you know, date for the next little while and see what happens. One or the other, however the book is. Yeah. But you definitely need to have those in an erotic.
You write paranormal romance as well.
Okay. I also write paranormal romances that are all set either in the Middle Ages. And then part of the same series, the characters are also their descendants. There are stories about them in the current day. The main focus of that is ancient Celtic mythology, like the Celts of Gaul, like the Gaulish Celts. So way, way ancient Celtic mythology. The goddess of the forest is Arduina. And she's the main character that's in all of those novels, and all of the gods and demigods and goddesses that are featured in each separate novel, they kind of follow her. They're her followers and they work for her. She's also the goddess of justice. So we work a lot of that. I work a lot of that into the whole series. I started out with four novellas of the four main characters of these, and they're the god of creation, the goddess of healing, the god of war, and the god of thunder. And those four were just medieval, a medieval family who had this bloodline running through them, and they became gods or goddesses or angels by the ends of their stories. And then one of them is in each of the books that take place later. So I mix a whole lot of Celtic mythology. I have a lot of my own theories I like to play around with, because I do include angels in there, and modern day Christianity, and all of the gods and goddesses in my books refer to God as the Almighty or the one God. Sometimes they refer to him as the Son or the Father or the Spirit. It just kind of depends. And so I get to play around a lot. There's also demons and things like that. So I get to play with all of my Bible stories from my childhood and kind of mesh them all together and play with different ideas about why things are and stuff. So that's a whole lot of fun. I really enjoy that. And since my first four characters in those books were immortal by the end of the story, they're able to be a secondary character in the contemporary books that I write. So there's a mixture there of medieval stuff as well as contemporary. And one of the characters married the heroine of his story is a descendant of Jesus. So God would not let them be in heaven together. So she gets reincarnated every time her life ends, she gets reincarnated. So I have a few short stories that I've thrown in of different time periods where he has to go and find her and make her fall in love with him again. So they're just little fillers that I put in. So yeah, so it really gives me an opportunity to just branch out and do all kinds of things. Which, you know, we used to not be able to do. You used to really be able, really locked into what your publisher wanted. But now in the age of self-publishing, we are our own masters.
Yeah, right. So are those stories spicy as well?
My paranormal stories are definitely spicy. Everything I write is spicy because I'm just, like I said, I have a spicy personality. Yeah. And I have sex on the brain a lot for some reason. I don't know. It could be from working with 13-year-olds that don't want to think about anything else but. So maybe, I don't know, it's kind of just in the back of my head. Who knows? My books have always been spicy. But the differences in the almost always, especially in the medievals, the heroine is a virgin, very inexperienced. Not necessarily prepared to try a lot of new things, but there's definitely a separation. There's a lot of romance, a lot of really mushy, sentimental things that go on, but also a very high level of heat when the actual consummation of their marriage and further right. experiences that they have. I explain them in a lot of detail. They're pretty lengthy. And there's usually a little bit more talking going on between the two characters during their sex acts for some reason. I don't know why more explanation is needed for some reason. But, so they're definitely spicy. But, I mean, you might not want your, you know, your teenage daughter to read them. But
great. So how many books roughly in total have you got now? Have you written now?
I have 11 that are printed out, that are out, wow. that have been published right now, 11.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Now, I also have several that have been published in different languages, Portuguese. Almost all of my books have been translated into Portuguese.
Have you gone to audio at all yet?
Not yet. It's on my list of things I want to do, but it's really difficult, you know, because I, like I said, I teach school. That keeps me very busy.
Yeah.
And stuff. And so I get up really early every morning to find a couple of hours to do my writing. I also do some sculpture and stuff. I sculpt these things to kind of complement my books so that I can go to fairs and things and sell my little sculptures and also sell my books and kind of make it all work as a one big thing. So I'm always looking for extra time. So, but definitely that's something that I want to look into. I haven't yet, but I'm going to. I've got a new book that's coming out this month in February, Gladiator Erotica, that's set in Pompeii years and years before the eruption when Pompeii was just a vacation town.
How do people react to you when you say what you do? For example, you meet new people. Do you introduce this right away, or do you wait and feel it out a bit, or you're at a party, it's all different, but how do people react?
I've been doing it for a long time, and at first I didn't tell people. Mm-hmm. Certainly before I got published, I didn't really tell people. And then after I got published, I was only published in erotica, and I was already living in Alabama. So I was a little reluctant, especially my husband works for the government, so most of the new people I would meet were there. So I was kind of careful at the beginning. Now, not so much. Now I'm like, oh yeah, I'm a writer. That's the first thing I say is I'm a writer. Mm-hmm. And then they all automatically want to know, well, what do you write? So then I tell them, I write romance novels. And so then they always ask more. And so I usually kind of go into, yeah, I don't ever tell them I write erotica. I don't really ever say that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Just because I know sometimes here in this area, people are kind of funny about stuff. So I just kind of avoid saying that in public, but I do tell them that my stuff is really spicy. And of course, then they have all the typical, how do you do your research? Yeah. And is that your husband modeling on the cover and all these kind of things. And a lot of romance writers in particular are offended and they have kind of burr up there behind about it. I don't. I love it. I have reveled in it as long as I can have been able to talk about it, you know, and I'm happy to joke around with people. And if they want to know about how I do my research, I can, I mean, you know, the, we got a new chaplain, for example, we got a new chaplain. I went to the reception that we had for him, and my husband and I had just celebrated our 30th anniversary. And he said, well, what's your secret? He asked the wrong person. What's your secret? It's a long marriage. And I said, oh, just a little light bondage. And everybody standing around was just kind of flabbergasted. And he just thought it was hilarious. It was great. So, so then we had, you know, lots of conversation with the new chaplain about bondage and marriage and, you know, that kind of thing. So it made it a lot of fun.
Well, Bambi, you are a genuine out there who I am person, and I love it.
Yeah,
I love
you it. Yeah, we do.
Well, yeah. So setting things in the past means you don't have to be politically correct. There's a thought.
Yeah, right.
So worry, because I would have thought that was to do with the reader, you know. But anyway,
I loved her. Her talking about the quickies.
Yes.
So that was a interesting choice of words. Mm. Interesting that she's saying even a character in erotic fiction has to experience some sort of transformational journey.
Right.
Yeah. So yes. The rules still apply.
I must confess, I have downloaded the first of the Viking trilogy, so I'll let you know how I get on with that. I love me a nice Viking.
I've read the Viking trilogy, and I was just so impressed with the cover. The man on the cover.
Oh, yes.
That was, and choosing your own covers is, you know, very important, the way she said. Mm-hmm. That.
What are the chances of sitting next to someone at dinner who is an author, and then an author who is in such an interesting subgenre?
Right. She's a delightful woman.
Really. She sounds it. She comes across.
Yeah. And of course, she, you know, living in the Bible Belt and doing what she does and being a teacher as well.
Yeah.
So she has to keep it all very incognito.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Her advice for writers, finish what you're writing. That comes over time and again when we meet these people. Yeah. It's about getting your bum on the seat and getting writing and getting it finished.
Right. When we were at dinner, I asked Bambi if she ever has the trouble that I do getting started, because she rises very early and writes before she goes off to her job. And I just, she said, oh, yes. And so that was comforting to me. That it's not just us who struggle with that sometimes.
But they just stick at it.
Well,
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sit the bums in the chairs and stare at the screen until something comes. You can get so exasperated with yourself that you start writing something.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one thing I've learned is being good at writing doesn't make you a writer.
No.
You know, you have to complete projects. Right. You have to kind of work at it. And just being able to sit and write, a good paragraph or two isn't only a starting point.
That's right. That's right.
Someday I must show you the first and last draft of Raymond Carver's I See the Smallest Things, because that's a real example of how, I mean, he's seen as a byword for literary,
excellence. Short stories, excellent,
But, you know, even he starts out with a first draft that is over wordy, overblown, over descriptive, and so on. And when you look at, because it's been published, the first draft and the last draft, when you look at the difference between the two, it shows how much work goes in to polishing and
after you, editing. After the writing.
So you write, and then you rewrite, and then you edit.
Yeah.
So, you know, anybody that thinks that you can sit down and write and it's a done deal after your first draft is really not getting the point.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Well, Hal, my husband, decided in retirement, he's going to write a book.
Whoa.
And he started doing an autobiography because he said he would like very much to, you know, pass it to his children and have it in the family. He didn't get very far. And he thought, I think he got about 100 pages on that. But he was discovering it's difficult.
Yeah.
Then he decided he would write about Alcibiades, who was this character in ancient Greece, and he got 12 pages. And he said, I've finished, I've run out. I've run out of things to say.
Did he not say, Linda, this writing is harder than I thought?
Well, he's never said that, but he stopped entirely. I said to him once, it's not easy, is mm-hmm. it? Mm-hmm. And he said, not like I thought.
Yeah.
So I think he respects what I'm doing now a lot more after his experience.
I think a lot of people think, you know, if you're a writer, you can work from home. You know, you can do you can have a proper life, and then you can dabble in a bit of writing and make millions of pounds. Yeah. It just doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen. As we all know.
Well, it's almost time for us to end this episode, but before we go, there's just time for Heather to tell us what she's reading at the moment. So, Heather, what's on your bedside table?
Well, I'd like to say it was erotic fiction, but I wasn't that clever to join the two things up. And I'm really not reading anything that's totally literary. I am reading Brit's Guide to Orlando by Simon and Susan Venice, because we're planning a trip to Orlando with the grandchildren. And so I got this book from Amazon, and I'm avidly reading it and about all the attractions in Orlando and getting quite excited. Unfortunately, it does mean I'm not reading all the things I should be reading and all the things that are waiting to be read. But if anybody is going to Orlando, it's excellent. It's got full of all sorts of information. Very, very good. And I'm quite excited about my forthcoming holiday.
Oh, it sounds like it's going to be wonderful. I understand that you're going to Louisiana,
Yes.
Going to be a great trip. Now we're going to hear from Teresa. What's on your bedside table?
Well, I'm absolutely loving Black Tudors, The Untold Story by Miranda Kaufman. And this is a non-fiction historical work. It's absolutely brilliantly researched and brought to life as well by Miranda, with lots and lots of background story. I'll just read you from the flyleaf. A black porter publicly whips a white Englishman in the hall of a Gloucester manor house. A Moroccan woman is baptised in a London church. Henry VIII dispatches a Mauritanian diver to salvage lost treasures from the Mary Rose. From long-forgotten records emerge the remarkable stories of Africans who lived free in Tudor England. They were present at some of the defining moments of the age. They were christened, married, and buried by the church. They were paid wages like any other Tudors. The untold stories of the Black Tudors, dazzlingly brought to life by Kaufman, transform how we see this most intriguing period of history. And my own personal favourite so far is Jacques Francis, the salvage diver. Mm-hmm. Now, these people have come into the historical record. These are just the ones we know about. And there were obviously many more black Africans in Tudor England than we were previously aware of. And one of the things that's interesting, so Jacques Francis was involved in a court case, and he was a witness in a court case, as were a number of the people who've come into the historical record. And what that shows us is two important things. They were not slaves, because a slave could not give witness in a court case, and they were baptised Christians because they swore an oath. So it's absolutely fascinating. And as I say, from the historical record, she then weaves around it. And the reason that the divers came from Africa to salvage the Mary Rose and other salvage jobs was because English sailors didn't learn to swim. It was partly a superstition, partly a practical thing, because if you're on a sailing boat and you fall off, they can't turn around. Mm-hmm. And if you can't swim, you die more quickly.
But they
were used to diving for sponges in Mauritania.
Free diving.
Yeah. And so that's absolutely fascinating. Wonderful, wonderful book. And I hope that you'll all
gorgeous
read it.
Gorgeous cover too.
It's beautiful, yeah.
Thank you.
I had no idea there were black Africans in Tudor Britain.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was aware because there was the famous needle maker, wasn't there? There was a Moor who had the secret to make Spanish needles. I've heard of that, you know, perhaps when studying Shakespeare or whatever.
Well, it's a very interesting book, I think, and I would like to read it. I had no idea either that about the people. I didn't know you had free blacks in Great Britain.
The other thing, I mean, one of the guys who's featured in the book circumnavigated the globe with Sir Francis Drake. He was in his household, but they met on a previous trip to the Caribbean. Francis Drake met this guy, Diego, and I think it's in that section of the book they meet people in Panama, what we would now call Panama. And when the Africans were taken, it was mainly by the Portuguese and Spanish at this point in history, were taken as slaves to Central America. About a third of them just ran away.
Yeah.
So there were these communities of black people living in the jungle, and they get together with them to kind of raid the Spanish silver. Drake gets together. But even people he met there would say, in England, there's no slavery. This was known all around the world, and black people knew it. If they got on English soil, they were free.
Ah, that's very
interesting. So it's really interesting. It's a fascinating book, and it really opened my eyes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can see you're excited about it.
I will pass it to you, Linda, when I finish it.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And now it's time to wrap up another episode. Thank you for listening. Subscribe to iTunes or Stitcher so every new show is automatically delivered wherever you want it. Join our Facebook group. Just search for Write Club the Podcast. Leave us a review or comments on any of the interesting things you hear. Tell a friend about Write Club to help us grow. So now we're out of here like a greased pig from a cannon. Goodbye.
Bye. Bye.